You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
So, let's do our motivation. Let's motivate about practicing fortitude in the face of things not going the way you want them to go. And recognizing that everything that happened is due to causes and conditions. Our karma is involved in it in one way or another. And so instead of getting upset at the external environment, accept it, cut the afflictions in our mind, and approach the situation in a positive way. Especially generating compassion, and an understanding of wisdom. And so let's have that as our motivation tonight. Just start on the questions. Let it warm up. We don't want to pressure you. Okay, sweetheart. Okay. So there's a couple of questions that came in. So it says, in the most recent Precious Garland talk, it seemed like you were saying that things are only conceptually fabricated. In terms of being meant, that's right. That's what I said. In terms of being mentally labeled as conceptual categories and given names or designations, I can see that that would be a mere conceptual fabrication. But isn't it also the case that things exist as wholes imputed on parts and that are not just conceptual? Isn't it that what common sense objects are? Isn't that what common sense objects are? And don't Galupas assert that such things can be known non-conceptually as well as conceptually. Of course, they are mere dependent arisings and not inherently existent. But to say things are just conceptually fabricated seems more like what the Galupas criticize non-Galupas for, an over-refutation that sees conventional reality as non-existent. Okay. So, what this person's thinking is common sense objects are wholes imputed on parts. Yeah? And that these things can be known conceptually as well as conceptually, yes. You know, the fact that things depend on conceptuality doesn't mean that they're only known by conceptual consciousness. It means that they depend on conceptuality. But the fact that somehow this person is thinking that after you impute a whole on a collection of parts, that then it becomes inherently existent. And it's no longer conceptually designated. That's what it seems like the problem is. Okay? And that's very much the way it seems to us. We impute things, and then we forget that we're the ones who imputed it, and think that things exist that way from their own side. Okay? So if you take the letter B, okay, when you just look at it as during her BBC talk, one line and then a three, yeah, you don't see a B. You put the I and the three together, and then we look at it and call it B. Okay, is it B from its own side? No, it's only a letter B because we agreed to call it B. Yeah. But after we learned that that shape is called B, and after we learned that it's a letter in the alphabet, then every time we see it, it appears to us as if it's a B from its own side. And we forget that we're the ones who gave it that name and who saw it, put those parts together and made an object out of it. Okay? So, yes, things are merely conceptually fabricated. Fabricated here means the same as designated. I'm sure this person would say, yes, things are conceptually designated. But after they're conceptually designated, they don't become inherently existent. Okay? They still are dependent. Yeah. And for somebody who grew up in another place where they don't have an alphabet or where this shape isn't called B, they would look at that shape and not think anything of it. Yeah? Or maybe they would, you know, I don't know, put it in some other way and call it some other name and not even see it as a letter of an alphabet, but see it as, I don't know, you know, people's eyes or who knows what they would see it as. Okay? But, yeah, so that indicates that it's not a letter B from its own side. It's because we called it that. Yeah. So things are fabricated by conception. But they still exist, even though they're fabricated by conception. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that everything we give a name to exists. Yeah. Because there has to be, you know, a jiving of the what that object is capable of doing with the definition that we have given that term. Yeah. So we can't call this a reindeer. Yeah, it doesn't function as a reindeer. Before anybody used the word reindeer, we could have called this a reindeer. Yeah. Because the word reindeer doesn't have any meaning in and of its own until we give it meaning. But once we agree that reindeer is, you know, lives with Santa at the North Pole, are there real reindeer? Or are they?
Yeah.
Oh, there are real reindeer. Okay.
No, I don't think they fly.
Oh, okay.
Don't fly. Oh, you have a face.
So, you know, if the sound reindeer weren't already taken, we could call it a reindeer and ascribe the meaning of this to that sound. Okay. But if you think, here's a building, right? Now, if you drove up and you didn't know, you know, you're one of the strangers driving around on Spring Valley Road, and you turn up and you drive up here, would you see this building and say, oh, that's a monastery? No. You might call it a
compound.
A what?
A compound.
You might call the whole thing a compound. Yeah. Or a campus. Yeah. Or you might call this building a house. Yeah. Okay, but there's nothing in this building from its side that would let you know that it's a monastery if you had no clue it was a monastery. Yeah, so its being a monastery depends on our having the idea of what a monastery is and giving this the name monastery. Those of you who were here at the very beginning of the Abbey might remember that I kept on having to remind people, this is a monastery, it's not a house, because people would come and visit us, And they would think of it as our house, and so they would want to socialize with us. Yeah, because you're going to visit these people who live in a house, and that's what you do. And we kept on having to say, no, it's a monastery. It's a monastery. It's not a house. It's a monastery. The building is the same. Yeah, but you call it a different name, and it changes in your mind, doesn't it? Okay. Even though the basis of the designation is the same. So there we can see that nothing in the basis of designation is the object. Yeah. And that this basis of designation becoming a monastery depends on being conceived of and labeled as a monastery. Or even if you came up and called it a compound, you're still far away from even knowing it's a monastery. Yeah. So, things exist in dependence on, two different words, being conceived and given a name. Yeah. So it's not like we give them a name and then from that, the side of that object, they become that thing such that everybody should know it's that thing they're after. Because that's not the case at all. Yeah. Okay? So I hope that's clear for the person who wrote it. If not, please write another question. Okay, now. Okay. I won't read the whole letter, but it says, my current understanding is that objects come into existence based on conceptuality, but their causes must also be designated at that time in order not to fall into thinking that thoughts are the actual causes for objects. Now, when you have the object, you no longer have the causes for that object. The causes and effect don't exist at that time. So, when you are giving the label, you have the basis of designation, and when you give the name, it becomes that object. So I don't understand this thing about their causes must also be designated at that time. What does that mean?
Well, I was saying that the thought isn't the cause of the object.
The thought is not the cause of the object.
Right. That was the point.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So the fact that things are merely designated doesn't mean that our thoughts cause the object. Okay, they have their own causes. Okay, so can you put your question? Did I answer your question?
Well, sorry, I guess my confusion is fabricated by conceptuality sounds like the object is caused by thought. But it's not caused by
anything. Oh, because fabricated means made.
Right.
I see. Okay. So it's a thing of language. Yeah. So you could say designated by thought, fabricated by thought. Either way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just saying that there's a cause and there's a designation. But those aren't the same thing.
I mean, the cause of the table is the wood.
Right.
Yeah. The designation is the table. Yeah. Okay. Now, what's interesting is when we talk about designation, we were saying that things don't need to be designated at, consistently in order to be that thing. You know, there doesn't need to be somebody designating something all the time for that thing to exist. There's the story of, the monk in the room who, you know, was puzzling about this and then thought, you know, if I go to sleep and nobody's designating the pillars, maybe the roof is going to fall down, okay? Because it won't exist, because it's not being designated. So something doesn't need to keep being designated by moment, okay? That's not what it means, okay? And we do, I mean, it's an interesting thing. If you look at, like, a few centuries ago, you know, if you asked anybody, did people die of cancer, nobody would know what to say. What's cancer? They would have no idea. Does that mean that cancer didn't exist a few centuries ago?
No.
Okay, so it existed, but for something to exist, it has to be designated. So what's the story? Did cancer exist, or did nobody die of cancer?
I think maybe you're asking two different things.
What do you mean?
People were dying, and they were dying of what we would call now cancer.
Uh-huh.
Simply because they didn't call it cancer at that time didn't mean they didn't die of it.
Right. But what did they die of?
Unknown causes.
Unknown causes.
Well, did they die of unknown causes, or did they die of cancer?
They didn't have the label then, so they would have called unknown causes.
Yeah.
But people were still dying of it.
They're still dying of it, but, you know, we say that things don't, you know, exist. They have to be, you know, designated in order to exist.
Probably was designated as disease.
Yeah, it probably was.
It just wasn't designated as cancer.
Yeah.
Basis.
Yeah, so it was designated as some disease or some symptoms. They died of some They died of some illness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was some designation. Retrospectively, it was labeled cancer. Okay. But things, you know, when you talk about conventionality, things you can begin to see where how things are fabricated by conceptuality because things are very messy. Yeah. If I say, what year was Venerable Jhampa born in? Okay, what year were you born in?
77.
77, okay. The same year I ordained.
Yes.
Oh. So, yeah. So, what year was Venerable Jhampa ordained in?
2013.
Hmm? 2013. You say 1977?
Born in or ordained in?
You said born in. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I'm born. What year was she born in?
1977.
But did Venerable...
She was Danny Moritz when she was born.
Yeah.
She wasn't Venerable Jhampa.
Yeah. So does that mean that Venerable Jhampa was never born?
Or she was born recently.
Or is she only 3 years old? You know? Who was born in 1977? Because that wasn't Venerable Jhampa in 1977, was it? Huh? A special little girl was born. Okay. Yeah. But, you know, if you say, well, when was Venerable Jhampa? Well, Venerable Jhampa didn't exist in 1977. And yet, can we say she wasn't born in 1977? On all her visa applications, it says she was born in 77.
Seems like yeah. We're using the words exist wrong. Should be exist and exist as.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you're saying she existed then, but she didn't exist as Venerable Jhampa. Mm-hmm.
Same with the cancer.
Okay. But we still say, you know, what year was she born? Was Venerable Jhampa born in? 77. Yeah, there's no problem in saying that. even though Venerable Jhampa didn't exist. There was no label Venerable Jhampa at that time. Yeah. So you could say, well, the child didn't exist. You know, the continuity, that body and mind didn't exist as Venerable Jhampa. What does it mean to exist as? Yes.
She was designated as Danielle. Uh-huh. And later, those aggregates kept in the same continuity, and she was designated as Venerable Jhampa.
Uh-huh.
So one is the substantial cause for this body and mind, and mm-hmm. the other is existing as.
Yeah. But when we say she is Venerable Jhampa, we don't say.
But she isn't.
Yeah, but we don't say she's designated as Venerable Jhampa. We say she is. Yeah, that's the point that I'm getting at. You know, that how we use language is very deceptive and very sloppy. Yeah. And yet still we understand. You know, when you plant a little tree, a little, you know, seed in the ground, people will say, I'm planting a tree. There's no tree there. You're not planting a tree. You're planting a seed. But nobody says, I'm planting a seed. They say, I'm planting a tree. Because we give the name of the effect to the cause. And everybody understands it.
You say that about all our vegetables, all of our flowers, we're planting.
Right. So the same way, saying that Venerable Jhampa was born in 77, we're giving the name of the result to the cause, even though that's not the thing itself. Yeah. So when we have ways in which we all understand things, but when you look at them, they're all kind of sloppy. Yeah. And when we try and examine and find out exactly what something is, we can't find it. You know, like, what is it that made her Venerable Jhampa? And what's the difference between Dani and Venerable Jhampa?
Precept body.
Do we see a precept body? Yeah? Yeah, it's true, that's the difference. But, you know, so did Dani stop existing and Venerable Jhampa started existing? Yeah, right. Yeah. According to the immigration office and your passport, Dani still exists. Yeah. But are Dani and Venerable Jhampa the same person? Are they the same person?
Not
inherently. Yeah. You can't say they're totally different people, can you?
No.
But you also can't say that they're the same.
So they're one entity, different isolates.
Ah! That's it.
That's the example Guy gives in his book, where he's like, is he Dr. Guy Newlin? Is he Guy? Is he, you know, they're all different.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But even had she... I mean, the thing, the basis of designation has changed too, because the person that was named Dani when she was born doesn't have anything to do. You wouldn't look at that baby and then look at who she is now and think they were the same person either. Mm-hmm.
But according to her passport, they're the same
right.
person.
You know, that's all. That's all.
So what does it mean to be the same person?
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The continuity.
Yeah. What does it mean to be the same person? She's not the same person as that baby. Okay, we're on verse 101, right? Okay. So, we're at the beginning of chapter 2. Oh, hooray. this one opens, what are we going to do on the trip? Okay, so chapter 2, an interwoven explanation of the causes and effects of higher rebirth and highest good. Okay, so in the first chapter, Nagarjuna explained a higher rebirth, then highest good. This time he starts out with highest good, then goes to higher rebirth, then comes back to highest good. Okay, so, having stimulated us to think about emptiness, now he's going to continue on that theme from the last chapter. So if things don't exist inherently, how do they exist? Yeah, they exist dependently. They exist like illusions. They exist falsely. They exist deceptively. Okay? They're not illusions, but they are like illusions. Yeah, this is quite important because with an illusion, there's no object that's really there. Yeah. But like illusion is talking about how it's appearing. An illusion, the way an illusion appears is not how it exists. So similarly here, things appear inherently existent. They don't exist that way. Okay, so verse 101. When one splits apart the plantain tree with all of its parts, one finds no core at all. So too, when one splits apart the person with its six constituents, one finds no essence at all. Okay? So, most tree, when you peel off the bark, you find the hardwood on the inside. With a plantain tree, you peel off the bark and there's nothing there. Because actually, it's not a tree. Yeah. Actually, it's a bush. And even though it can grow up to like 20, 25 feet tall, what looks like the trunk of a tree is not. It's the sheaves. Just collected sheaves of leaves, okay? So, what appears to be a tree trunk at the base of the plant is actually a pseudo-stem made of layers of leaf sheaths. So because it's just the sheaths of leaves, there's no hardwood inside, even though, you think you're cutting a tree. So, the idea is you're cutting this tree and there's no hardwood. There's no core to it at all. Yeah. So similar to this, when we search for the basis of designation to find a person, we don't find one. Okay. So whether we search the aggregates, the constituents, the elements, the elemental derivatives, whether we look at the collection of the aggregates or one aggregate, more, at a time, no person can be found. There is not a person there. Yeah. This relates back to that first question. We designate person, and then we think it's a whole, one person. But there's no person there. And yet the person's sitting on a chair. The person's sitting on a chair, but there is no person there. Okay, so one's talking conventionally, one is talking ultimately. Okay, so although the person depends on the constituents, aggregates, and so forth, it's not any of them individually, it's not the collection of them, and it's also not found separate from all these components. And so the same is true for whatever phenomena we look at. It cannot be found in its basis of designation, and it can also not be found separate from its basis of designation. And so for that reason, we say it exists by being merely designated. Yeah. But we designate, and then we forget that we called it the name and gave it a meaning, and we start to think that there's something from the side of the object. Okay. Verse 102, hence the victors have said that all things are selfless. It has been demonstrated to you that the six constituents are selfless. Okay, so this going back, remember, we talked before how the person lack here self. When we're talking about things being selfless, self doesn't refer to the person, it refers to the object of negation. So selfless means it doesn't have the object of negation, which is inherent existence, true existence, existence from its own side, and so forth. Okay? So all things are empty of, you know, when it says all things are selfless, all things lack some inherent existence. And so whether you're looking at the whole object, or you pull out one part of the object, or a part of the part, anything you pull out to examine, it all exists dependent on designation. Okay. So 103, in this way, neither self nor non-self are ultimately perceived just as they are. Therefore, the great sage refuted both views of self and non-self. So the Buddha is called the great sage because his body, speech, and mind are untainted by even the slightest faults or defilements. Okay. And having rejected the views of both self and non-self being inherently existent, he leads others to abandon those wrong views. So he's called the great sage. So here, self, you know, in this way, here, in this, you know, the word self changes according to what we're referring to, okay? So here, when it says in this way, neither self nor non-self are ultimately perceived just as they are, self here means person. Non-self means the emptiness of the person. Okay? So neither the person nor its emptiness truly exist, inherently exist, or exist from its own side. Okay? Remember, several verses ago, we had somebody say, well, okay, the object doesn't inherently exist, but the emptiness of the object inherently exists. No, it doesn't. Neither the object nor its emptiness has any existence from its own side. So that was verse 98, it said that, okay? So then someone comes along and says, you're saying all phenomena are selfless contradicts what the Buddha himself stated because he taught the existence of the self. And that's true. To some people who are trainees who are similar to Vaibhasikas in disposition, he said that there was a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. To others, he said that the self exists but is not expressible as either permanent or impermanent. Yeah. Or when he spoke to other people, he said, you know, there's no permanent, partless, independent self. Okay. So he said different things to different... When he spoke to some people, he said, there is a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Other people, he said, there is a self that's not expressible as either permanent or impermanent. Okay, so he made those statements asserting a self. So although it seems like the Buddha is contradicting himself when speaking to these diverse groups of followers, that's not the case, because none of what he's saying is his actual view. Yeah? When we talk about the Buddha's intention, that means his actual view, None of these are his actual view. All of what he's saying is called provisional. It's what he's saying to those particular people, because that's what will help them at that time. So we don't say that the Buddha's lying. Okay? It's he's being skillful and saying to those people what will help them in the long term. Okay? And he's not contradicting himself either. Okay? So, in fact, the Buddha's own view, the Buddha's intention, was that there is no self. So it rejected both a self-sufficient, substantially existent person and the inherent existence of that kind of person. Okay. So when the verse says, neither self nor non-self are ultimately perceived just as they are, it indicates that when we analyze both the person and the emptiness of the person, or the selflessness of the person, to see if they inherently exist, we don't find even an atom of inherent existence. Okay? So for this reason, we say that the Buddha refuted both the views of a self and non-self. In other words, the person is selfless, and that selflessness itself is selfless or empty. Okay. So that's one way of explaining that verse according to the Buddha's own thought. Another way of explaining it is you say there's a conventionally existent self that comes from the previous life and goes on to the subsequent life. And that person creates karma and experiences its happy and painful results. Such a self exists, but it's not a permanent, unitary, and independent self. Okay? So here, the great sage refuted the view grasping the inherent existence of both that conventionally existent self and its selflessness. It's just another slant on it, okay? So in short, as a skillful teacher who addressed the specific needs of each audience, the Buddha taught what was suitable for that audience, okay? His definitive meaning is both the person and the emptiness of the person are without inherent existence. Even though he said sometimes the substantially existent person, a substantially existent person exists. Okay. So we're not disputing the existence of a conventionally existent person here. So 104 and 105, as for what one sees, hears, and so on, the sage did not call them either true or false. If from one position its opposite arises, both do not exist in fact. Okay. Hence, this world is ultimately beyond truth and falsity. Therefore, the Buddha does not accept that it really exists or does not. That seems totally contradictory, doesn't it? Okay. So what one sees, hears, and so on refers to the objects of the six senses, our five physical senses, and the mental sense, mental consciousness. Okay. So the Buddha said that these objects are not true or not real, meaning that they're not truly existent. Yeah. He also said that they are not false or unreal. But we might be kind of going, because usually we hear that conventional objects are false and are unreal. Don't we? We usually hear, you know, these things exist falsely. They don't exist truly. Okay? So generally speaking, objects of the senses are false because they don't exist as they appear. They're obscured truths, you know, truths for an obscured mind. The ultimate truth, emptiness, on the other hand, exists the way it appears. So emptiness is true, although it's not truly existent. Okay? Yeah? It's true, it exists the way it appears. But it's not truly existent, because it doesn't exist independent of other things. So in saying that the objects of the six consciousnesses are neither true nor false, the Buddha is actually negating the two extremes. Because here, true means truly existent, and false means totally non-existent. Yeah? So, you know, the way they use words in a lot of the philosophical texts, they will have different meanings in different contexts. Usually, false means it doesn't exist as it appears. Here, false means non-existent. In a preceding, in one verse, non-thing means something that's permanent. In another verse, non-thing means non-existent. Okay? So here, false means not existent. Yeah? So, sights, sounds, and so forth don't truly exist. They are not true. However, they're not totally non-existent. They do exist, so they are not false. Okay. So saying that they're not true, in other words, that they're not truly existent, refutes the extreme of absolutism, and saying that they're not false, in other words, that they're not non-existent, refutes the extreme of nihilism. So when it says both in fact do not exist, that indicates that both true existence and total non-existence do not exist. Yeah, in reference to conventionally existent things. Okay, if from one position its opposite arises, okay, so here, somebody says, yeah, when this is what that line means. When true existence is negated on an object, it must be non-truly existent, because non-true existence and true existence are directly contradictory. True. Something that is not truly existent is non-truly existent. That's correct. Okay? But that person thinks that non-truly existent means it doesn't exist at all. Okay? And what he's saying, in that case, non-true existence must be truly existent. Yeah. So if you negate true existence on the table, then the table must be non-truly existent. And that non-true existence, that emptiness of true existence, must truly exist, because it's got to exist, because if something doesn't truly exist, it doesn't exist at all. Okay? But that's not correct, because as we talked about before, emptiness is posited in relationship to the basis, the object that it is empty, that object that is empty. So the person, the aggregates, the computer, whatever. Okay, so being dependent on these objects that are the basis of emptiness, emptiness is also empty of true existence. Okay, so both do not exist in fact means both non-true existence or emptiness and true existence do not truly exist. That's the meaning of the phrase both do not exist in fact. You have to put truly exist in fact. Okay, because remember lots of times they say things but they don't put in the qualifying word. Okay, so ultimately the world transcends being truly existent and being totally non-existent. For this reason, the sage doesn't say it really exists or does not exist. Because he can't say it's inherently existent or totally non-existent. Okay. So then, verse 106, how could the omniscient one say that what he knows to be utterly non-existent is finite or infinite, both or neither? Okay. So here we're coming back to the Buddha's reason for not making a statement regarding the four extremes. Because remember in verses 73 and 74, it talked about that during the Buddha's lifetime there were people who came and asked him questions about the world and about the self, and they were basing their questions on an assumption that things truly existed. So no matter what the Buddha said, you know, it wouldn't be the correct answer because they're hearing the answer in terms of true existence. Okay? So, the Buddha remained silent. And then some people said, well, he doesn't know the answer. But people who really understood why the Buddha didn't answer took his not answering as a sign of his great wisdom, because they realized that, you know, when people said, you know, does the person exist, not exist, both or neither? Is the universe finite, infinite, both or neither? That these people were, you know, whatever he said, they would get the wrong idea and it would harm him. So they saw his silence as indicative of his wisdom. Okay. So within the context of inherent existence, he couldn't give a truthful answer. So asked if the self had an end, didn't have an end, if the self is finite, infinite, both or neither, he could not make an accurate statement because there's no inherently existent self to start with. So asking if the people are thinking there's an inherently existent self, and they're asking, is it finite, infinite, both or neither? In other words, does it end at the time of this life? Does it continue to the next life, you know, eternally? both or neither? Yeah. So asking that kind of question is like asking, is a turtle's mustache soft, coarse, both or neither? Okay. How can you say the quality of the turtle's mustache when there's no such thing that exists? Okay. So most of these kind of questions that these people put to the Buddha were in the form of a tetralemma. You know, does the world end, have an end, not have an end, both have an end, and or neither have an end or not an end? Yeah, okay. But none of those could be true if you're thinking within the framework of true existence. Okay? So if they're, in this particular one, you know, asking, is the world finite, infinite, both or neither, okay? If there were a beginning to cyclic existence, so if it were finite in the sense of the past, that there were a beginning, yeah, there would have to be some time in the past where cyclic existence and did not exist and then later came into being. So if that were the case, that there was a time when there was no cyclic existence and then it came into being, then either cyclic existence was created by no cause or it was created by a discordant cause. Because there's no cause to create cyclic existence when it didn't exist before, because ignorance keeps cyclic existence going. If there were no cyclic existence, there were no ignorance. So there, you know, you couldn't have a time when there was ignorance and no cyclic existence. Okay. So, but then you're left with, okay, then does cyclic existence come without a cause? Well, that's ridiculous, because nothing that arises and functions exists without a cause. Okay. Did it come from a discordant cause? A discordant cause is a cause that doesn't have the capacity to produce that object, like a creator. So then you have to say either the, you know, samsara is randomly created, which some people say, yeah, very well-educated people say that, or they say it was created by a creator, which is a discordant cause, which also some very intelligent people believe. So you see, intelligence in a secular way has nothing to do with intelligence in a Dharma way. Yeah. Okay, because both those options are untenable, and there's no other cause. You know, what cause are you going to assert that produce cyclic existence if it can't be ignorance? Yeah? What else could there be? Okay. So, yeah. Okay, so while cyclic existence has no beginning, it does have an end. Okay? So if, he gives an example here of a seed. Yeah. So the example is just an example. It doesn't hold, every aspect of it doesn't hold. But if we have a seed in our hand and we think about the causes of the seed and the causes of the causes and the causes of the causes, we see that there is an infinite regression of causes of the seed. So there was no beginning to the seed. But there is an end to the continuum of the seed. Because if we burn the seed, then there's no plant that continues, so there's no future seeds. Okay, so the continuum of that plant has ceased. Okay, so it has no beginning, but it does have an end. Okay, so similarly, while the ignorance, that's the root of cyclic existence, has no beginning. It does have an end because it can be eradicated by the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay. Now why, the question then comes back, well, why didn't the Buddha, you know, how could the omniscient one say that what he knows to be utterly non-existent is finite or infinite, both or neither? Oh, so this one's saying, yeah, how could the Buddha possibly have given an answer to that question? There's no way he could have. Okay, that's what the verses means. Okay, then 107. There have been innumerable past Buddhas. Likewise, future Buddhas and present Buddhas are innumerable. And the extent of the three times sentient beings is considered to be zillions of times more than those Buddhas. So the world cessation occurring in the three times does not cause its increase. Why then did the omniscient one maintain that its beginning and end are indeterminate? Okay, so the explanation here is a little bit long, but let's do it anyway. Okay, so what somebody is asking, what somebody is saying here, is it's wrong for the Buddha not to answer the question about cyclic existence having an end or not having an end, because there is an end to cyclic existence. Why didn't the Buddha answer the question? You know, he knows that, yeah? And we know that there is a time when each sentient being's samsaric lives will be ended. You know, why? Because in the past there were numberless Buddhas who came. In the future there's numberless Buddhas coming. In the present there's numberless Buddhas. you know? And even though there's zillions of times more sentient beings than there are Buddhas, at least at this moment, the number of sentient beings is always decreasing because each of these Buddhas leads zillions of sentient beings to a liberation and awakening by teaching them the path. Okay. Furthermore, no new sentient beings are coming into existence, so there's no increase in the number of sentient beings, only a decrease as more sentient beings are constantly attaining liberation and awakening. So there will be an end to cyclic existence. In that case, why didn't the omniscient one make a statement on this matter instead of leaving it unanswered? Why didn't he say, yeah, there's an end to cyclic existence? Okay. Probably because, you know, people would think that if there's an end to cyclic existence, then there's no continuum of the aggregates whatsoever, and everything becomes totally non-existent. Yeah, because if you have a truly existent cyclic existence, and that ends, then you have nothingness. And he didn't want to give them, you know, that idea. Okay, so saying sentient beings are countless or numberless means that the number is so great that you can't count it, but it doesn't exactly mean infinite. Okay? So, it's true that the number of sentient beings is constantly decreasing. Okay? So, by not saying there's an end to cyclic existence, the Buddha isn't refuting that fact. Okay? He did not respond because the person asking the question was working under the assumption that sentient beings were inherently existent, and it would have been harmful, not helpful, to him if the Buddha had replied, because the person's belief in an inherently existent person would have only increased, or they would have thought that you know, there was no person at all. Okay, so suppose the Buddha answered the question by saying, what kind of sentient being are you referring to?
Yeah.
You know, when the person says, you know, does a sentient being, you know, have an end, not have an end, both and neither? Okay, so if the Buddha said, you know, what kind of sentient being is it? If it's in a conventionally existent sentient being who exists by mere name, yes, there is an end to this person's samsara, okay? A sentient being that exists by mere conceptual designation wanders in samsara under the influence of afflictions and karma, but that same mere I, conventionally existent person, meets the Dharma, learns the Dharma, hears, thinks, and meditates on the path, you know, purifies their mind of the defilements, and attain the liberation, so that person does have, there is an end to that person's cyclic existence. Okay? But, the Buddha says, if you're talking about an inherently existent person, and asking if an inherently existent person's samsara ends, I can't answer that because there's no inherently existent person to start with. Okay? So in general, when we talk about samsara, we say there is no beginning to sentient beings or to cyclic existence. But each sentient being's cyclic existence has an end, no matter what realm he or she is currently born in. Okay? So each sentient being has the Buddha nature as an inseparable part of their mind. Yeah, the adventitious stains that cause cyclic existence are not in the nature of that person's mind. There's an antidote to remove those afflictions, the wisdom realized emptiness. So, it's possible for everybody to attain awakening, even a hell being. Okay? Even a preta, even an animal. It doesn't mean that they can attain awakening in that lifetime, but they can attain awakening. I remember when Geshe Tenchok was talking about this, you know, because he said, well, we say each sentient being attains awakening. So, you know, when the donkey is later born as a human being and that human being attains awakening, the donkey also attains awakening. That sounds so strange, doesn't it? Yeah, because actually the donkey no longer exists. Yeah, but we say every sentient being can attain awakening. So unless we say that that donkey attained awakening, then we can't say the donkey has the Buddha nature. Okay. So remember, we were talking about this, you know, when the person, you know, Sam attains awakening, all Sam's previous lives, we say, attain awakening. But actually, none of them exist in that present moment, but their continuum exists. Okay? So while that hell being may not attain a liberation in their present body, in the future, when they have a good rebirth, they will someday. Okay? So in general, there's a time when each sentient being will attain full awakening. Although the hell being, the donkey, can't attain awakening in that particular life. Okay? So if countless Buddhists have helped and are helping sentient beings attain awakening, why haven't we become Buddhas yet? If there's infinite beginningless lifetimes, there's infinite number of Buddhas, all the Buddhas are manifesting to teach us, why haven't we attained enlightenment yet? Okay. Because in order for us to become Buddhas, all the necessary conditions must be present, and they haven't been present yet. Yeah, we have to be born at a time when a wheel-turning Buddha has come. We must meet with a fully qualified Mahayana and Vajrayana spiritual mentors. We must have interest for the Dharma. We must have, you know, all the other conditions for practice. And not all those other conditions have come together yet. Yeah. And even if they do come together, the last condition is, do we use those conditions to practice and attain the goal? So somehow, not all of that has come together. So in spite of there being beginningless time and, you know, all these Buddhas, we still aren't Buddhas yet. Okay? So while all sentient beings have the potential to become a Buddha, most sentient beings are not receptive to the Dharma at this present moment and do not, you know, learn, think about, meditate on the path. And without creating those causes, there's no way for them to attain Buddhahood at that time. Okay. So when you think in this way, yeah, it's difficult to think of a time when all sentient beings will be awakened. So although there's no time when there were no Buddhas, it doesn't mean that some beings were always Buddhas. Okay, so because we say there's beginningless Buddhas and beginningless time, it doesn't mean that there was somebody who's a Buddha who was not first a sentient being, that someone just came into existence as a Buddha. That's not the case. So all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas were once sentient beings, and through practicing the path, they attained the result. Okay. And so, so there's nobody who's always been a Buddha. So the virtue sentient beings create is related to the Buddha's awakening activity, and is due to the blessings, and inspiration of the Buddha. of the Buddhas, actually. So since virtue has existed in the mind streams of sentient beings since beginningless time, and its cause is the Buddha's awakening activity, then there must be beginningless Buddhas. Okay? And the chief way the Buddha's awakening activity manifests is by giving teachings. And so then through hearing the teachings, knowing what to practice, what to abandon, then sentient beings can create virtue and abandon non-virtue. And without the Buddha's awakening activity, they couldn't do that. So there must be beginningless Buddhas, okay? So, because in general, if there were no Buddhas in the universe, then you couldn't have any bodhisattvas, you couldn't have any arhats, you couldn't have any virtue, okay? Nevertheless, this does not mean that there are Buddhas who were never sentient beings prior to attaining awakening. So some people say that the first Buddha was the all-pure Dharmakaya. Or, you know, the first Buddha is Samantabhadra, something like that. However, each sentient being has to attain the Dharmakaya through training in the path. To say that there was a first Buddha, we would have to posit a Buddha before that who was the teaching of the first Buddha. Then the first Buddha isn't the first Buddha. There was another Buddha before. And that one, if that one's the first Buddha, it had a teacher before who was a Buddha ad infinitum. Okay? But in a historical sense, when we talk about our particular universe, our particular world system, this world system had a beginning. And it has a finite number of Buddhas. You know, where it's said, this world system is said to exist in the fortunate eon, where there's 1,000 wheel-turning Buddhas. So Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth of those. Okay. However, it's not like before these 1,000 Buddhas in our particular world system, it's not that before that there were no Buddhas, you know. There were lots of Buddhas in lots of prior world systems, okay? But we can't say that any of those Buddhas was always a Buddha and never a sentient being. Okay? It didn't take too long, did it? Okay. So we're a little over time, but if you have any questions, yeah?
Somewhere I read that Sumatra was the primordial Buddha who has never had ignorance.
Who has never...
Never had ignorance.
Yeah, but he's saying, no, that when you talk about Samantabhadra in that way, you're not referring to an actual Buddha. Yeah, because all Buddhas must have been sentient beings at some time or another. Okay, yeah. Okay, yes, the Buddha's mind is empty of inherent existence. Everything is empty of inherent existence. Nothing truly exists. What does the Buddha's mind depend on? Well, to become a Buddha, you have to have been a sentient being before. So a Buddha's mind is a continue. The clear and knowing nature of the Buddha's mind is a continuation of the clear and knowing not mind. Clear and knowing of the mind of a sentient being. What else is the Buddha dependent on? The two collections of wisdom and merit. Okay. So don't think of the Buddha as some kind of absolute, truly existent thing.
I can't really make that logic work at all. There was never not a Buddha.
When you talk about infinity, things take on a whole different meaning. When there's infinity, yeah, you know, there were always Buddhas there, because if there were never Buddhas, then you couldn't have a first Buddha before that.
Yeah, I see that logic, but I can't get the different ones to all work together.
What can't you get it off?
I can't see how these hang together in a way.
Can you express it in a different way? How what hangs together? The fact that every sentient...
I can't make their argument work, I guess.
Okay. Maybe think if you can explain it to me later, like how you see a contradiction in the argument, then... Okay.
Mm-hmm. The person continues, so does the Buddha's mind continue to change?
Yes. The Buddha's mind is impermanent. It changes moment by moment. The Buddha's mind is omniscient. It sees everything that exists. All those things are changing moment by moment. So, of course, the Buddha's mind has to change moment by moment, too. Okay. But that doesn't mean that the Buddha can lose their enlightened state, because there's no cause to make them lose their enlightened state. Okay? So changing moment by moment does not mean that the continuum is, you know, has to cease. There's nothing that can stop the continuum of clarity and knowing of the mind.
Uh-huh. Question: how does bodhicitta, which is in the mind of an imperfect, ordinary sentient being, result as the mind of a perfect being? Is it like a, you know, how when something imperfect is the cause of something perfect, is the cause not concordant with the effect?
Right. Yeah. So yes, that this comes up on the debating ground, because you can't say that something that's polluted is the cause of something that's not polluted. Yeah, so that's why I said the clear and knowing nature of the sentient being's mind is the cause of the clear and knowing nature of the Buddha's mind. I didn't say that all of a sentient being's mind is the cause of a Buddha's mind. Okay. Shall we dedicate?
May the spiritual teacher soon lead me on the sacred path, and our spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may it stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Atravasi Abbey in the West,